Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, students. This is Erica, your instructor for pharmacology. Today we're going to do Chapter 10 and review some local anesthetics. And this is going to have to do with describing how local anesthetics work. It's also going to explain how local anesthetics can reduce pain without affecting the muscles that control posture. And how they can be administered through injection. And it's also going to talk a little bit about the different adverse effects associated with local anesthetics. Now, of course, you know I'm going to have a video for you guys to listen to on local anesthetics regarding pharmacology and toxicity. So we'll listen to that a little bit later. So let's just dive right in. Drugs may be used in many different ways to control pain. General anesthetics will be discussed later in Chapter 18. General anesthetics abolish the response to pain by depressing the CNS and producing loss of consciousness. However, it may be desirable to relieve pain without altering the alertness or mental function of the patient. To accomplish this, analgesics, opioid and non-opioid, or local anesthetics may be used. The source and intensity of the pain determines which of these pharmacological agents is most useful to decrease the response to the painful stimuli. Local anesthetics, as their name suggests, produce a temporary loss of sensation or feeling in a confined area of body. You look over there on page 98, you will see the key terms for this chapter, and it's continued on page 99. The most common clinical use of local anesthetics is to abolish painful stimulation prior to surgical, dental, or obstetric procedures. In addition, local anesthetics are ingredients in many over-the-counter products for sunburn, insect bites, and hemorrhoids. Local anesthetics abolish the response to pain because they inhibit sensory nerves that carry painful stimuli to the CNS. What's the sensory nerve that carries messages to the CNS? Afferent nerve pathway, afferent. In particular, local anesthetics block nerve fiber conduction by acting directly on nerve membranes. Local anesthetics interact with the nerve membranes to inhibit sodium ions from crossing the membranes. If sodium ion movement is inhibited, nerves cannot depolarize and conduction of impulses along the nerves are blocked. This blockade of nerve conduction is reversible, which means that when the local anesthetic is carried away from the nerve by the circulation, the action of the local anesthetic ends. The local anesthetic is then metabolized. Sensory nerves carry impulses for pain, touch, warmth, and cold to the brain. The sensory and autonomic nerves are the first fibers to become blocked by local anesthetics because these fibers are relatively small in diameter and unprotected by myelin sheaths. Therefore, local anesthetics can easily penetrate the membranes and inhibit nerve conduction. In contrast, the motor nerves that supply skeletal muscle are the last fibers to be inhibited because motor nerves are large fibers with thick myelin coverings. The importance of this varying degree of nerve depression presented, as you can see in Tableton 1, is that pain fibers can be blocked without altering skeletal muscle function. For example, diaphragm and posture. In addition, the pain fibers that are last to recover from the local anesthetic blockade. Now, pharmacology. The most commonly used local anesthetics are listed in Table 10-2 on page 101. These agents produce adequate nerve block by inhibiting nerve conduction. They differ in their duration of action, site of metabolism, and potency. There are two classes of local anesthetics, ester local anesthetics and amide local anesthetics. Let's go ahead and look at page 101, and you can see some of the common local anesthetics. One that should be familiar to you that you've probably encountered just through routine doctor visits would probably be benzocaine, tetracaine, which you most often are used in doctor's offices, bupivacaine, lidocaine, used before any kind of injection procedures, irrigation and drainage procedures. They used it before placing staples, before placing sutures, and you know, of course, lidocaine is also used in a dental office. LET, the lidocaine, epinephrine, and tetracaine, that is used before suturing or getting stitches. You have ethyl chloride, which might be sprayed before they remove a wart. So you have some familiar items on that list. Okay. Let's go over the difference real quick between these two. In general, ester local anesthetics have a short or moderate duration of action because they are metabolized by enzymes, the cholinesterases, that are present in the blood and skin. Example of ester local anesthetics are benzocaine and cocaine, cyclomethane, procaine, and tetracaine. However, tetracaine is the only ester derivative that has a very long duration of action. It is too large a molecule to be rapidly metabolized by the liver. Now, the amide local anesthetics are usually the longer-acting drugs because these agents must be metabolized by the liver. The amide group include dubicane, lidocaine, mepivacaine, and procainamide. Now, in regards to routes of administration, the duration of action and potency of local anesthetics determine which route of administration to employ. Local anesthetics are administered topically or by injection. Ester anesthetics, particularly those found in over-the-counter preparations, are applied topically to the skin or mucous membranes. Topical application of local anesthetic is also known as surface anesthesia. Topical preparations are available as creams, lotions, ointments, sprays, suppositories, eye drops, and lozenges. The most recent development in topical anesthetic includes combination local anesthetics applied to open an intact wound or skin to reduce pain prior to suturing, such as LET gel, lidocaine, epinephrine, and tetracaine. The first available combination was TAC, tetracaine, adrenaline, cocaine. This preparation, although extremely effective, is being phased out by combinations that do not contain what? Cocaine. And we already talked about the LET gel. It's now it's not commercially available over the counter, but it's used in most doctor's offices before suturing. Other routes would be injection of local anesthetics may involve several different sites, including under the skin or intradermal, and into the spaces around the spinal cord, spinal, epidural, or caudal anesthesia. The long-acting potent amide anesthetics are administered primarily by injection. Then you have infiltration anesthesia, which is achieved by injecting a local anesthetic directly into the tissue. The extent of anesthesia is determined by depth of tissue penetration, that is, the tissue infiltrated. You also have, we already said that cocaine was one of the first local anesthetics to be discovered, but although it has potent local anesthetic activity, cocaine cannot be used by injection because it produces intense vasoconstriction. So that means your blood vessels become very tight and clot off. So, and it also interferes with the sympathetic nervous system and blood vessels. But today, cocaine is used topically in surgical procedures on the eyes and nasal mucosa because it's a vasoconstriction action. Decreases because of the vasoconstrictor action, it decreases operative bleeding and improves surgical visualization. So, you know how when you watch surgery on TV, they're constantly wiping or suctioning the secretions or the blood, because some of our organs are very vascular, which means they have a very rich blood supply, which means they bleed a lot. So there are certain local anesthetics or certain anesthetics or anesthesia that can be used, or actually I should say anesthetics, that can be used that cause vasoconstriction or a vasoconstricting effect, which means the vessels tighten, or they tighten up or they clamp down, which decreases the bleeding. So that way, when they are operating, it's less blood flow, and they can see the organs and make the repair easier. Now, note to the healthcare professional, local anesthetic solutions occasionally contain epinephrine to counteract the vasodilation that occurs. Always read the contents of the bottle before administering a local anesthetic. Local anesthetic preparations that contain epinephrine should not be used for nerve block or in areas of the fingers, toes, ears, nose, or penis. In such areas, epinephrine may produce intense vasoconstriction leading to ischemia and gangrene. Epinephrine is also contraindicated in conjunction with general anesthetics that increase cardiac excitability. So do not use epinephrine in fingers, toes, ears, and nose, or penis, okay, because of the vasoconstrictive effect. It can cause ischemia, which means decreased blood supply, and therefore cause cell death, which therefore gangrene, you get it, et cetera, et cetera. Let's see. Local anesthetics are administered to produce a pharmacological response in a well-defined area of the body. However, a local anesthetic occasionally is absorbed into the blood from the site of administration and passing through the circulation. It affects tissues and organs along the way. The most frequent and serious side effects from systemic absorption of local anesthetic involve the blood vessels, heart, and brain. Now, the cardiac effects of local anesthetics could be depressed in the function of the cardiac conduction system and the myocardium. Usually, these drugs produce a negative conotropic and negative inotropic response on the heart. In toxic doses, local anesthetics produce cardiac arrhythmias, so that's abnormal heart rates or abnormal heart rhythms. And it must be pointed out that in a therapeutic subtoxic doses, two of the local anesthetics can be administered intravenously to correct certain cardiac arrhythmias. Lidocaine and procainamide are unique drugs because at very low doses they can protect cardiac function, while at toxic doses they inhibit normal cardiac function. The role of lidocaine and procainamide in the therapy of cardiac arrhythmias will be later discussed in Chapter 23. Now, for some clinical applications, you want to know that topical application of local anesthetics relieves pain and itching associated with sunburn, skin abrasions, insect bites, and other allergic reactions and skin eruptions from chickenpox. Rectal suppositories relieve the pain produced by hemorrhoids. Introduction of a patch containing local anesthetic has used in dental procedures to reduce the pain associated with anesthetic injection and to alleviate painful discomfort following herpes zoster neuralgia. That herpes zoster is that's the same organism that's responsible for chickenpox or shingles. And sometimes after a shingles episode, you can develop this neuralgia, which is severe nerve pain that sometimes can last for years. You might find some people who have to take something like gabapentin, or they have to use some type of daily injection to kind of just deal with that pain after having one of those illnesses. Also, local anesthetics may release histamine from the mast cells located at that site of injection, producing a rash and local itching typical of a histamic response. So occasionally, a patient is hypersensitive to local anesthetics. If a rash or edema occurs, this drug should be stopped immediately. Hypersensitivity may develop to ester local anesthetics when they are used frequently. For this reason, topical preparations, creams, ointments, and sprays should never be used continually or for prolonged periods. So you find for people who have acute allergic reactions, rashes, or some type of dermatitis, you'll find that they're only supposed to use it like a week or two. You do not want to use prolonged creams or lotions like that because you can develop a sensitivity from repeated exposure and therefore, you know, become hypersensitive to it or they're allergic to it, causing you not to be able to use that product again. So you'll find with a lot of the topical anesthetics that they're only really meant for one-time use or use while you're doing a procedure. They're really not meant for everyday use or prolonged use. Things to consider when administering local anesthetics parenterally, you want to always monitor the cardiovascular and respiratory vital signs after each injection. These drugs administered parenterally or through IV can cause some restlessness, dizziness, blurred vision, slurred speech, and those may be early signs of CNS toxicity. So always inject an anesthetic slowly to avoid systemic reactions. Debilitated patients, as well as elderly and pediatric patients, may require reduced doses because these patients are often more susceptible to the actions of local anesthetics. Local anesthetic solutions that contain a vasoconstrictor must be used with extreme caution in patients who have a medical history of hypertension, cerebrovascular insufficiency, heart block, thyrotoxicosis, or diabetes. An overdose of topical anesthetics may result in the same life-threatening responses from parenterally administered drugs. If convulsions occur, it is an acute emergency. There is no specific antidote. So supportive treatments include maintaining a clear airway and assisting ventilation with oxygen. If convulsions persist, an ultra-short-acting barbiturate or benzodiazepine may be given parenterally. Intravenous fluids and vasopressors are used when circulation and organ perfusion are compromised. Also, you need to know about the central nervous system effects of these local anesthetics. All of the local anesthetics can affect the central nervous system in large or toxic doses. The local anesthetics can cross the blood-brain barrier and initially stimulate the cerebral cortex. The symptoms of cortical stimulation are nervousness, excitation, tremors, and convulsions. In general, the more potent the anesthetic, the more readily convulsions occur. As the concentration of local anesthetic increases in the brain, all areas of the CNS become depressed. Finally, at toxic levels, local anesthetics produce coma and death due to total depression of the central nervous system. Treatment of a local anesthetic overdose when a CNS excitation is present includes barbiturates or diazepam. or Valium. Once total CNS depression has occurred, the only available treatment is supportive restoration of breathing and blood pressure. In particular, artificial respiration is the essential feature of treatment in the late phase of anesthetic intoxication. That's why anesthesiologists get paid. That's why they have very high liability insurance. Okay? We also want to go over some little side notes here. You always want to be teaching your patients before procedures and after procedures, before admission and after admission. You always want to be teaching them about what's going on, what the treatment plan is, what the expected outcomes are. So it's very important that the patient be advised that the loss of sensory perception and motor function may persist for a short time. This means that the anesthetized region cannot respond to hard or cold stimuli or to deep scratching. They also want to avoid. You want to make sure that they avoid exposing the skin or the mucous membranes or gums to extreme temperature fluids for at least an hour before full pain sensation has returned. That's why after you go to the dentist, they always advise you to not eat for at least 2 hours, because you know how you have that numbing effect. You can't feel your tongue, you can't feel your face, you can't feel that side of your face or your jaw, and you often bite the insides of your cheek. So you really want to wait till that anesthetic kind of wears off so you can be aware, because you don't want to burn yourself. I've seen some people end up with some pretty nasty burns because they were trying to eat right after and they could not tell how hot the food was, but they, once that anesthesia wore off, they were very well aware. So always teach your patients before and after procedures, whether it's a topical or parenteral injection that they receive. You always want them to know how long they can expect for the anesthesia to stay in their body, what the side effects are, what the adverse effects may be, and watch for any signs of toxicity. Okay. Now I want to play a short video for you talking about pharmacology and toxicity. See if I can get this to play. Hold on just one moment. So this lecture that you're going to listen to is just going to kind of go over local anesthetics.
So looking by the region without the loss of consciousness, the discovery of local anesthetic was written in Italy. Goes back to 700 BC, first came from...
Hold on, that's not the video that I want to show you. And I'm going to send these videos, like I said, to your links. Just one moment. Okay. I'm going to send these links to you talking about the local anesthetics, the esters, amides. Just one moment. It's going to review the esters and amides. Okay.
What are the local anesthetics that are esters? The local anesthetics that are esters include procaine, cocaine, and tetracaine. What are the local anesthetics that are amides? The local anesthetics that are amides include lidocaine, mepivacaine, and bupivacaine. What is the mnemonic to help you remember amides' local anesthetics? The mnemonic to help you remember this is that amides have two eyes in them, so that lidocaine, mepivacaine, and bupivacaine all have two eyes in them. What is the mechanism of action of local anesthetics? The mechanism of action is to block the sodium channels by binding to specific receptors on inner portion of channels, and the local anesthetics preferentially binds to activated sodium channels, so these drugs are more effective in rapid-firing neurons. Describe the mechanism of action of tertiary amine local anesthetics. Tertiary amine local anesthetics penetrate membrane in uncharged form, and then it binds to ion channels as charged form. What drug is given along with local anesthetics to increase the effectiveness of the local anesthesia? Local anesthetics can be given with vasoconstrictors such as epinephrine to enhance their action, and the reason for this is because of vasoconstrictors, there would be decrease in bleeding, and it also increases anesthesia effect by decreasing the systemic concentration. Describe why in infected or acidic tissue there is more anesthesia that's needed. In infected or acidic tissue, there is more anesthesia that's required because alkaline anesthetics are charged and they cannot penetrate membrane effectively. So because of this, there is need for more anesthetic. Describe the order of nerve blockade with local anesthetics. The nerve blockade happens faster in small diameter fibers than in large diameter fibers, and myelinated fibers than in unmyelinated fibers. But overall, the size factor predominates over myelination, so overall, the order of nerve blockade goes small myelinated fibers, followed by small unmyelinated fibers, followed by large myelinated fibers, and then large unmyelinated fibers. What is the order of sensation loss with local anesthesia, naming them from the earliest sensation loss to the latest sensation loss? The first sensation loss with local anesthesia goes pain, followed by temperature, then it's touch, and finally pressure. What is the clinical use of local anesthesia? Local anesthesia is used in minor surgical procedures as well as final anesthesia. What local anesthesias are given if a patient is allergic to esters anesthesia? If a patient is allergic to esters local anesthetics, then you give them amides. What are the side effects and toxicities observed with local anesthetics? Local anesthetics can lead to CNS excitation, severe cardiovascular toxicity that happens with bupivacaine. Hypertension can also occur along with hypotension and arrhythmias, and arrhythmias can occur with cocaine use. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the description section below.
Okay, so let's just review that information. A local anesthetic is a drug that causes reversible local anesthesia, generally for the aim of having a local analgesic effect, that is, inducing absence of pain sensation. Although other local senses are often affected as well, usually you're just blocking the specific nerve pathways that conduct pain signals. Okay? Clinical local anesthetics belong to one of two classes, amidamide and aminoester local anesthetics. So you said amides and we said esters. Synthetic local anesthetics are structurally related to cocaine. They differ from cocaine mainly in that they have a very low abuse potential and do not produce hypertension or, with few exceptions, vasoconstriction. Local anesthetics are used in various techniques for local anesthesia, such as topical anesthesia, which is surface, infiltration, plexus block, epidurals or caudals, spinal anesthesias. The medical uses for local anesthetics would be to treat acute pain, chronic pain, or in the essence of surgery, podiatry, or dentistry. With acute pain, local anesthetics may be used to treat pain that occurs shortly after surgery, after trauma, infection, or any disruption of blood circulation, or and any other condition in which there is some tissue injury. In the medical setting, it is usually desirable to alleviate pain when its warning function is no longer needed. Besides improving patient comfort, pain therapy can also reduce harmful physiological consequences of untreated pain. In nursing, you will find that untreated pain prolongs healing. So do not be afraid to medicate patients after surgery or if they are in pain. Untreated pain prolongs healing, okay? And that's one of the biggest lessons you'll learn in nursing. Untreated pain prolongs healing time. Acute pain can often be managed using analgesics. However, conduction anesthesia may be preferable because of superior pain control and fewer side effects. For purposes of pain therapy, local anesthetic drugs are often given by repeated injection or continuous infusion through a catheter. Low doses of local anesthetic drugs can be sufficient so that muscle weakness does not occur and patients may be mobilized. Some typical uses of conduction anesthesia for acute pain are labor pain, postoperative pain, and trauma. Now, for chronic pain is a complex and often serious condition that requires diagnosis and treatment by an expert in pain medicine. Local anesthetics can be applied repeatedly or continuously for prolonged periods to relieve chronic pain, usually in combination with medications such as opiates, NSAIDs, or anticonvulsants. In regards to surgery, virtually every part of the body can be anesthetized using conduction anesthesia. However, only a limited number of techniques are common in clinical use. Sometimes conduction anesthesia is combined with general anesthesia or sedation for the patient's comfort and ease of surgery. So we already talked about that this will be used in dentistry, podiatry or eye surgery, ENT surgery. Okay. Other uses would be topical uses of anesthesia. Topical anesthesia in the form of lidocaine or prilocaine, better known as Imla, is most commonly used to enable relatively painless venipuncture, blood collection, and placement of intravenous cannula. It may also be suitable for other kinds of punctures such as ascites drainage and amniocentesis. Surface anesthesia also facilitates some endoscopic procedures such as bronchoscopy or cystoscopy. Some of the undesired effects of local anesthetics are increased bleeding, prolonged anesthesia or paresthesia, tingling or feeling of pins and needles, or strange sensations. The risk of temporary or permanent nerve damage varies between different locations and types of nerve blocks used. Okay? Now, I want you to go ahead and familiarize yourself with Chapter 10, and then for your homework, I just want you to do questions I want you to do all the questions on page 106 and then go ahead and finish up to 10. So under acquiring knowledge, you're going to do questions 1 through 10, and you're going to do understanding terminology questions 1 through 9. So homework, chapter 10, understanding terminology questions 1 through 9, acquiring knowledge questions 1 through 10. Okay, now let's just go ahead and switch gears and go over into the dosage and calculation class. And remember, I told you that for this class from here on out, it's just going to be basically sending you links to these videos so you can practice the different kind of problems that you'll have to do. Because practice, you know, makes perfect, and, you know, you need to learn how to double-check these problems and learn how to do them different ways. So I want to go ahead and play a video for you, and right now I'm going to play the first 30 minutes of this video, and it's just going to go over for you some of the dimensional analysis for beginning nursing and dosage calculations. And right now what I'm trying to do is make sure that you guys will be able to hear this, because otherwise, well, you'll be able to, it probably will take better. Hold on just one moment.
Get all the latest county news delivered straight to your inbox by signing up for email newsletters at GwinnettCounty.com.
All right, so this video, I'm getting ready to send you guys the link right now. So I want you to take this link, and I want you to follow along in this video. She is going to go over dimensional analysis, and this is basically trying to figure out what you're solving for. So when you read a physician's orders, are you trying to find out the milliliters, the milligrams? Are you trying to find out the drip rate or the rate per hour? What is it exactly you are solving for, okay? And in order to solve these problems, you have to kind of break the word problems down. So this video is really great at understanding that. So listen to my friend Julie. And I'm sending you the link, so click on the link and then watch this video.
That's going to help you set up your problem the way to get anything to work and how to solve for any kind of problem. So let's try a simple problem to get started. The physician orders 1,000 milliliters of D5W to infuse over 8 hours. How fast will you run the drip in milliliters per hour to complete? So in this problem, what are we solving for? Well, we're solving for milliliters per hour. So we need to set up our problem. So whatever you're solving for, you want to write down and then put your equal sign, because that's going to help you direct where you're going to start. So in this problem, we're solving for milliliters per hour. So where in our problem did we see milliliters? Well, we've got 1,000 milliliters right here over 8 hours. So we're going to start off with whatever's on the top here that we're solving for, we want to start with on the top right here. So we're going to start with our 1,000 milliliters. In this problem, then, we're looking for time underneath. So in our problem, we had 8 hours. 1,000 milliliters over 8 hours. So this one's pretty simple to set up. Our first equation here, 1,000 milliliters divided by 8 hours, gives us our milliliters per hour. So when we do the math, 1,000 divided by 8, we get 125. So in this problem, we would run the drip at 125 milliliters to complete it in 8 hours as prescribed. So now let's look at it for drug dosage calculation. A nurse practitioner orders Digoxin 0.125 milligrams PO daily. The drug is supplied as 250 micrograms per tablet. How many tablets would you administer? First thing we need to see is that we have milligrams and micrograms in this problem. So we need to convert to like units. I'm going to choose to convert to micrograms for both so we don't have a decimal point, but you could just as easily change both of them to milligrams and work the problem that way. So we need to figure out how many micrograms is in 0.125 milligrams. So we can use dimensional analysis for that as well. So what are we going to solve for? We're going to solve for micrograms. So we want to start with micrograms on top, and we know from our conversion that 1,000 micrograms is 1 milligram. So then do we need milligrams in our problem? No, we need micrograms, so we need to get rid of milligrams. So this is where we bring in our milligrams. So we put 0.125 milligrams over here, and we cross out, cancel out, our units we don't need, just like in algebra from high school. So then we do our math, 1,000 times 0.125 equals 125 micrograms. So 0.125 milligrams equals 125 micrograms. And now we can go on to solve our problem. So if we're looking for tablets in our problem, so we're going to come over here and write tablets equals. So when tabs is what we're solving for, we want to start with tab right here. So in our problem, we knew that there were tablets that were equal to 250 micrograms per each tablet. Now we want tablets, not micrograms, so we need to get rid of micrograms. So our order is 125 micrograms. So again, see how we cancel out our like units, leaving us with tablets? And we do the math here, 125 divided by 250 equals 0.5 tablets. So in this problem, to deliver 125 micrograms with 250 microgram tablets, we would give 1/2 tablet. Let's try another one. Prednisone, 15 milligrams is ordered daily for a patient with asthma. Prednisone is available in 5 milligram tablets. How many tablets will we administer per dose? So again, what are we solving for? We're solving for tablets. So we're going to come down here and write tabs, and then we want to start with tabs on the top. So in this problem, we have 5 milligram tablets. So 1 tablet equals 5 milligrams. We want to get rid of the milligrams, so that's where our 15 milligrams in the problem comes in. Multiply that by 15 milligrams. We can cancel out the milligrams, leaving us with our tablets. So 15 divided by 5 is 3 tablets. So in this problem, we would give 3 tablets to administer our 15 milligram dose. We can also use dimensional analysis for drop factor configurations. So we use drop factors when no IV pump is available and we're just using the tubing to count drops. It's calculated in drops per minute, and we have two different kinds of tubing. We have macro-drip tubing and micro-drip tubing. Macro-drip tubing varies. It can be anywhere 10 drops per milliliter, 12 drops, 15 drops per milliliter. So in the problem, when you're using macro-drip tubing, we will give you how many drops per milliliter is there. But in micro-drip tubing, it is always 60 drops per milliliter. So in some of your problems, it may not indicate that 60 drops per milliliter is micro-drip tubing. It might just state there's micro-drip tubing in use. And you have to remember that that will always be 60 drops per milliliter. So we can use dimensional analysis in these kind of problems as well. In this problem, the physician orders an IV cefazolin 500 milligrams and 50 milliliters of D5W to be administered over 30 minutes. The tubing drip factor is 15 drops per milliliter. What rate will we run the drug in drops per minute? So what are we solving for? We're going to be solving for drops per minute. So we want to start with our drops per minute. So the problem gave us our drop factor of 15 drops per milliliter. But we don't want milliliters in our problem, we want minutes. So milliliters in our problem comes next. We want to get rid of that. So in our problem, it talked about 50 milliliters, and then over our time, over 30 minutes. Remember, our problem said 50 milliliters over 30 minutes. Now, we don't need this 500 milligrams in the problem. That's just a distractor. What we really need is this volume, 50 milliliters, over this time, 30 minutes, with this tubing, 15 drops per milliliter. So then we can cross out milliliters. That leaves us with drops per minute. We do the math. 15 times 50 is 750 divided by 30 equals 25. So the answer in this problem would be 25 drops per minute. Let's try another one. We need to administer 500 milliliters of D5 normosaline over 4 hours. There's no pump available, and our tubing drop factor is 10 drops per milliliter. How many drops per minute will we run the fluid? So again, solving for drops per minute. So if we have drops on the top here, we want to start with drops here. So our tubing was 10 drops per milliliter. We needed to give 500 milliliters over 4 hours. But we want minutes in our problem here, so we need to convert this 4 hours to minutes. So we can put in another conversion here. 1 hour is 60 minutes, and now we're going to do our math. So we're going to multiply across like this. So 10 times 500 times 1 is 5,000, and 4 times 60 is 240. So in this problem, 5,000 divided by 240, we get a number of 20.833333. Now, for solving for drops per minute, we can't count a partial drop. Not even Superman can do that, I think. So in these drop questions, for drops per minute, we need to round to the nearest whole number. So just like we do in our dosage calculation, if our number is 0.49 or down or less, we're going to round down, and 0.5 or up, we're going to round up. So in this problem, when we get 20.8, we're going to go ahead and round that up to 21. All right, let's try one more problem. 100 milliliters of D5.5 normal saline over 2 hours with microdrip tubing. So again, we're solving for drops per minute, and we're using microdrip tubing, which is 60 drops per milliliter. Notice that it didn't tell you that in the problem. You have to remember it. So again, solving for drops per minute. So we want to start with our drops on top. So we'll start with our drip factor, 60 drops per milliliter. We need to deliver 100 milliliters in 2 hours. Again, we want minutes, so we need to convert our hours to minutes. Right here, 60 times 100 times 1 is 6,000. 2 times 60 is 120. We do the math, and we come up with an answer of 50 drops per minute. Your Ogden dosage calculation book has some more problems like this in there if you need some more practice. There will be some practice problems up on Blackboard in your course to help you practice these kind of problems. There will be dosage calculation on every exam that you have, so make sure you get these right. And I'm going to strongly suggest to you that you start understanding and utilizing dimensional analysis for your dosage calculation. It is the one way you'll go into MedSurg 1 and MedSurg 2 and really be able to understand dosage calculations a lot better as we start doing advanced math. I hope that helped, and if you have any questions, please give us a holler. Thanks a lot.
All right. Julie gives some great examples there on dimensional analysis. And it's very important before you solve a math equation for nursing that you really understand what it is that you're solving for. So knowing that can definitely help you get to the solution quicker. Okay, so we're also going to go over some more videos in regards to medication or dosage calculations or medication calculate or dosage calculations for medications. That's just a mouthful. Because I really want you guys to become familiar with the type of problems that you will encounter, how to break them down, how to look at a drug label, and really understand what you need to get from that medication and how to give the patient the appropriate dose. So this one, next video, it's going to go over dosage calculations when looking at different drug labels. So remember, we reviewed drug labels extensively in an earlier dosage and calculation class. We took our time and went through labels one by one, learning each part of the label from the NDC number to the expiration date to the brand name and generic name that may be found on the label to the warnings, take with food, don't drink with take with alcohol, to if you're supposed to take this at night or if you're supposed to take this four times a day. So looking at drug labels and really reading them and see what all information is on there is very important before administering any medication. You want to be sure that the patient understands the drug label or understands the directions for taking it versus, you know, you take this with food or take it after eating with meals or after eating, or take this only at bedtime or take it first thing in the morning. It's very important that you go through those instructions with your patients and have them repeat it. There is no problem with having them repeat this information because you want to make sure that they have an understanding. Sometimes just nodding and saying, okay, I got it, you know, then they get home and they have no idea what you were talking about. And so this next video is going to go over a lot of examples with medication labels. From the medication label, you need to determine what should be given and how much, okay? So I'm going to send the link to this video to you now, and I want to make sure you guys are able to follow along. Flag word for today will be dosage. Dosage.
Finding out how many pills should be given to a patient, given a prescribed dosage. Remember, what we're doing here is, first of all, figuring out exactly how much of the drug there is in one tablet. Okay, this is going to be the dose per measure, remember. The dose per measure is the crucial factor we need in order to do the calculation. Now, we're told here that the patient is prescribed 40 milligrams. So we know that the dose prescribed is 40 milligrams. We also know from the packaging that the dose per measure is 5 milligrams. It's here and it tells us how much is in one pill, 5 milligrams per pill. So now all we need to do is do the calculation. To do that, we let our readers make sure that we know the correct formula, so the number of measures is equal to the dose prescribed over the dose per measure, which in this case is equal to the 40 milligrams which is prescribed over the 5 milligrams which is the dose per measure. Remember, we're checking here by having milligrams on top and milligrams on bottom. These things cancel out. 40 divided by 5 is just going to give us 8 tablets. Oh joy, that was simple. Remember though, the key thing here is to, first of all, make sure that you know what the dose prescribed is. You're going to be given that. The second thing is to make sure that you've got the dose per measure. And it's got to be in the same units as the actual dosage itself. So this is in milligrams, this would have to be in milligrams. If this was not in milligrams, then you would have to do some form of unit conversion. So the first thing to do really is to write the two things down that you're expected to know, the dose prescribed, the dose per measure. Then we simply apply the formula that the number of measures, which in this case of course is the number of tablets, is equal to the dose prescribed divided by the dose per measure. Here it's 40 milligrams over 5 milligrams, which just tells us that we have 8 tablets. Well, let's see if we can do this next one. Again, this is a tablet calculation. Question simply says, a service user is prescribed 2.25 grams of this metformin hydrochloride. Is that metformin hydrochloride? Yeah, that's right. How many tablets should be given? Well, again, let's just figure out what we know and what we should know. We should know the amount of the drug there is in each pill. Well, in this case, we can see clearly from the labeling that we've got 750 milligrams per pill. So this is the dose per measure, remember. But we also know from the question itself, or you will know from the prescription, that the dose prescribed in this case is simply 2.25 grams, whereas the dose per measure in this case is 750 milligrams. Well, straight away, as you probably can see already, we've got a bit of a problem because the dose prescribed is in grams, and the dose per measure is in milligrams. So we're going to have to do some form of conversion. It doesn't really matter which one you convert. We could convert the dose prescribed here. We could convert the 2.25 grams into milligrams. Or we could convert the 750 milligrams into grams, it's not going to make any difference. But just for this case, let's suppose we're going to change the dose prescribed into milligrams. Well, what's 2.25 grams in milligrams? Let's take a look at that. Remember, on our conversion chart, we've got kilograms, grams, and milligrams. So we're going from grams to milligrams. We're going down the scale here. So that means you're going to do what? You bet your boots. We're going to multiply by 1,000, okay? So you need to remember that. So when we do this, we're simply going to say that the dose prescribed is going to be, it's 2.25 grams now, but that's going to be equal to 2.25 multiplied by 1,000, which is going to equal 2,250 milligrams. Okay. So that's our dosage prescribed, 2,250 milligrams. So now all we need to do, because we've got the dose per measure in milligrams, we've got the dose prescribed in milligrams. So the number of measures, in other words, the number of pills, is going to be equal to the dose prescribed, or the dose per measure, which is simply going to be 2,250 milligrams over our 750 milligrams. Remember, we've got milligrams and milligrams, so we can cross that out. And 2,250 divided by 750 is going to give us 3 tablets, if I'm not mistaken. Notice, in this case, we still needed the dose prescribed and we needed the dose per measure. But remember, we had to do this conversion. We can't use this formula if the dose prescribed and the dose per measure in different units. They must be in the same units. So we had to convert this grams to milligrams. Once we've done that, we applied the formula, Bob's your uncle, Fanny's your aunt, 3 tablets needed. It would have given exactly the same result if we converted the milligrams here and the dose per measure to grams by dividing by 1,000. We would have simply got 2.25 divided by 0.75, and again, that would have given us the 3 that we've got. Hey, we've got a calculation for oral suspension, which is very, very similar to the calculations for pills, essentially. The first thing we need to do is to figure out the dose per measure, and in the case of oral suspension, the dose per measure is always going to be the amount of the drug there is in 5 mil. So we look at the labelling over here, and here you can see it tells us that there are 80 mil in half a teaspoon. Well, that's not what we want. We want this thing here. We need to know that there's 160 milligrams per 5 millilitres. That's what we're really interested in here. That's going to be the dose per measure. We're already told what the dose prescribed is. That comes with the question. So we've got 480 milligrams prescribed. So the first thing we're going to do is just write these facts down. So let's have a look. The dose prescribed then is going to be 480 milligrams. And the dose per measure is over here, and it's 160 milligrams per 5 mil. So it's 160 milligrams. Okay, so now we've got the information that we need. Now we need to remember what the formula is. Well, what's the formula? The formula is simply going to say that the number of measures, which in this case is simply going to be the number of teaspoonfuls, is that right? Yes, it is. Which is going to be the dose prescribed over the dose per measure. Well, what is the dose prescribed? Well, we found out earlier. It's 480 milligrams. And what's the dose per measure? Well, it's 160 milligrams. Remember, we're doing this as a check, so we can cancel off the units there, just in case the dose per measure and the dose prescribed were given in different units. But now we can just do the math, which is just 480 divided by 160, which simply gives us 3 spoonfuls. Here's another oral suspension calculation. And again, for this one, we're going to need the dose prescribed, and we're also going to need the dose per measure. The dose prescribed is something which is already given, so we're told that the patient in this case requires 90 milligrams, so we can write this in. And the dose per measure, remember, for oral suspension, is always the amount of the drug there is in 5 milliliters. So we look at the labeling to see if it'll tell us this. Well, we can see here that it says 6 milligrams per milliliter. In other words, there's 6 milligrams in 1 milliliter of the stuff. But it doesn't really tell us anywhere how much of the stuff there is in 5 milliliters. So we're going to have to do just a little calculation just to work that out. Well, if there is 6 milligrams in 1 milliliter, it must mean there's 5 times more in 5 milliliters, and 6 fives are going to give us 30 milligrams. So there's going to be 30 milligrams in 5 milliliters. So our dose per measure in this case is going to be 30 milligrams. Okay, so we have to do this separate calculation there just to see how much of the drug there is in 5 milliliters, because that's the dose per measure. Okay. Once we've got these two numbers, the dose per measure and the dose prescribed, again, we can simply apply the formula that the number of measures, which remember, in this case, is simply going to be the number of 5 milliliter spoonfuls we're going to need. The number of measures is going to be the dose prescribed over the dose per measure, which is going to be our 90 milligrams over our 30 milligrams. Again, we're doing the check here, milligrams on top, milligrams on the bottom. And 90 divided by 30 is going to give us 3 spoonfuls. Complete genius. Now let's look at dosage by injection. As with dosage by pill and dosage by oral suspension, you're always going to need the dose prescribed, and you're also going to need the dose per measure. Now, whereas the dose per measure for pills was just the amount of the drug that was in a pill, and the dose per measure for oral suspension is the amount of drug in 5 milliliters, here the dose per measure, remember, is the total amount of the drug there is in the vial or ampoule that you're dealing with, okay? So that's the first thing we really need to check. We need to check that we know how much of the drug there is in the entire vial or ampoule. So the first thing we're going to do is just look for how much fluid there is in the actual vial itself. And we can see this down here. It tells us that it's a 40 milliliter vial, 40 milliliter multi-dose vial. So we're looking for how much of the drug there is in 40 milliliters. Well, rather wonderfully, up here, it tells us there's 200 milligrams in every 40 milliliters. So this is what we're looking for when it comes to the dose per measure. So let's just quickly slot that in now before we make a hash of it. 40 milliliters is how much is in the vial. We know that there are 200 milligrams in 40 milliliters, so let's get that down. There's 200 milligrams in there, so that's the dose per measure. Now, from the question, we can see how much is being prescribed here, and it's 25 milligrams. So this is the information we need here. We need the dose prescribed, 25 milligrams. We need the dose per measure, 200 milligrams. They're both in the same units, yeah. So we're laughing tea cakes. Now remember, you're going to do this calculation in two steps. So step one, remember in step one, all we're going to figure out is the fraction of the vial that we need to draw up. So to do...
Okay, students, so that was the last video that I'm going to play for today. So what I want you guys to do is that if you have your drug and calculations book, I want you to be able to follow along with Julie and Mike and practice some of these word problems that involve the medication labels and also dimensional analysis. It's very important that you understand how to work these problems. It's not all the time that when you work in an office setting or a hospital, everything is going to be calculated for you, especially when it comes to drips or suspensions that you have to mix up yourselves. So it's very important that you have to do this. And also, remember that I said that some companies require you to do yearly bullseye checks or skills checks, and usually a part of those skills checks is a math review. So please do yourselves a favor and become familiar with this material and do the practice questions in both of these lectures. I've sent the links to you guys in emails. As usual, I'll also send some links to reinforce the local anesthetic lecture that was done earlier. If you guys have any questions, feel free to email me. And be sure that you do the Chapter 10 homework and remember what the flag word was. Until next time, have a good night.